And tonight, we are fortunate to have Jason from Happy Valley, Oregon. Please give him a welcome. Jason, thank you for coming.
Thank you. My name is Jason Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober to the only person who got a solution to the book of problems. Billy, last time I spoke in on the East Coast, there was a guy naked cleaning a gun. I think Billy might have been in on that one. So that was kind of interesting for me. So I'm learning how to do these Zoom things. They're kind of different, kind of strange to me. It's like, I don't know, sitting in a room all by yourself, talking to yourself. So bear with me a little bit on this. You know, if there's anybody here, you want to welcome and need an Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you've been around a long time, thank you for sticking around. You know, the cool thing about this, what we're going through right now, I mean, I can look at all the negatives about it. Right. But the big book tells me if I look at what's good about it, the better it gets. And what I've done is I've been able to meet a lot of people I would have never got to meet. I've gotten to go places through a computer that I never would have got to go. So I would have never probably ever got to meet any of you folks on my journey through Alcoholics Anonymous. But because of this deal we're going through right now, I've been given a gift. You know, I'm the kind of guy that when I drink, I don't stop until I run out or pass out. And if I put something else in my body, I usually don't stop till I get caught. You know, I have a sponsor. His name's Carl M. He's out of Covina, California. He knows he sponsors me. I'm that one kid guy that, you know, he always says there's two kinds of people in AA, those who show you what to do and those who show you what not to do. And they're both equally as important. And so I kind of fall on what not to do sometimes. I sponsor quite a few guys, and I have a home group. My home group is called AWOL. It meets on Thursday nights at 7, so that's probably 10 o'clock your guys' time, I think. But if you're up and you want to get on, give me a text. Get my number from Billy, and the code. We have to, we keep getting bombed for some reason. I think it's one of the other AA groups picking on us. But if you want to be involved, we're always there. Let's do this thing. You know, I my mom and dad got divorced. I didn't think. But what happened was my mom was an old hippie, and we lived in the back of a truck that had a house built on the back of it, or we live in a teepee, or we live in a tent. But we always lived up in the woods, right? My mom was into harvesting pot back then before it was legal. And so she was just an old hippie. And what I found out, there was a whole group of people, maybe 20, one little area in a camped out. And, you know, the thing was, is I would see those people fight and drink at night and beat up each other. And I'd see my mom get beat up, right? And then the next morning, I'd see my mom in love with him, right? Kissing on him and hugging on him. So I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. I didn't know that was different. I just thought that's how everybody lived, right? I didn't know there was anything different. At 5 or 6 years old, all you're trying to do is survive, right? I knew when the noise started going and the drinking started going that I went and found my place in the tent or my place in the cabin or wherever we were staying. And I found a place that was safe. And that's how I learned how to adapt. And I learned how to put up feel things that when emotion came, and I don't know if that didn't make me an alcoholic, but it warped my thinking a little bit. I didn't know back then that was going to be an issue for me. I didn't know that was an issue. You know, my life changed when I was going into the first grade. My mom had moved back to town about a year before that, and we had this house, and at this house, it was a party house, right? My mom was 19 years old when she had me, so she was probably 25 at this time. Lord knows what I was doing at 25. But what happened was is there would sometimes be a whole bunch of people at the house partying. But most of the time, there'd be nobody at the house at all. And, you know, I learned how to survive. I learned how to cook macaroni and cheese on the stove. I learned how to make my own soup. I learned how to make cereal. I learned how to take a bath. I learned how to put myself to sleep. But most importantly, I learned how to survive by myself. And to do that, what I would do is I would just pull down all the blinds in the house and turn all the lights on. And I'd turn the TV in the kitchen on, and I'd turn the TV in the front room on really loud so it sounded like there was a party there, so that if somebody came to break in, they would think there's a whole bunch of people in there and leave. And that was my game plan almost every night, you know, because my mom hung out at the tavern quite often. But, you know, my life changed when I was getting ready to go into the first grade. It was the night before school started, and I was at home watching Happy Days on TV. I don't know. Hopefully somebody knows what Happy Days is. I just spoke at a young person's meeting, and not one person looked at me on the screen. I could see him Googling stuff, trying to figure out what it was. But I was watching Happy Days, minding my own business, right? And the phone just starts ringing. And it's not like today's kind of phone where you can let it go to voicemail. It's just ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. So I answer it, and it's my grandma. And I don't know about you guys back there, but out here, my grandma is like very enthused about my life, right? She wanted to know everything about what was going on. She wanted to know if I was ready for school the next day. She wanted to know if I showered or took in a bath. She wanted to know if I had my clothes laid out, if I had my new shoes laid out. I mean, just stuff that were annoying, right? Just she was just wasting my time, right? And so I finally told her, hey, Grandma, I'm watching TV. I got to go. And she said, well, let me talk to your mom. And I told her, Grandma, my mom's not here. She said, where is she at? I said, she's at the tavern. The phone number is 282-4440. If you call down there, ask for Darla. She'll come to the phone in a little bit, and she's going to tell you she's having one more pitcher of beer, and she'll be home. And I remember there was this big pause, and I was trying to get irritated because nobody was saying anything. And she finally said, sweetie, give me that number again. And I gave her the number. And she said, well, when your show's over, I want you to go to bed. And when you get up and go to school tomorrow, I want you to listen to what the teacher says and be nice to the other kids. And I said, all right. So I'm on my couch now watching Laverne and Shirley, because that's what comes on next, minding my own business. And I hear a knock at the door. And my heart just drops, right? And I'm thinking, oh, man. So they start beating on the front door. And so I panic, and I crawl underneath the coffee table, and then I hear him knocking on the window on the side of the house, and I know for sure I'm dead, right? I just know it, right? And I'm just scared to death. And all of a sudden, I hear this voice that says, Jason, it's Grandma. Come open the door. And when I heard her say that, I just felt relief, right? I just felt, wow, my grandma's here, right? And I went to that front door, and I opened up that door, and my grandma looked like she had been crying. She looked mad, but she just said, grab your stuff. You're coming to live at my house. And I don't know about anybody else, but when you go to Grandma's house, there's Rice Krispie treats, there's homemade popsicles, there's cookies, there's food in the cupboard, there's pillows, there's sheets that match the pillows, and there's somebody there all the time. I'm like, well, I'm in, right? You don't have to ask me twice. So I grab my new clothes, and I jump in her car, and we drive to her house. And, you know, I ran up these stairs, and I'm going through the front door to go to the kitchen, because I know that's where the Rice Krispie treats, but you have to go through the front room. And I hear this, hey, and I turn around, and there's my grandpa, right? He's just staring at me. He says, what are you doing here? I was like, I live here now. You know what I mean? And he didn't, he just looked at me like, what the heck? And, you know, what I found out later was that my grandma didn't go tell my grandpa, hey, I'm going to pick Jason up and bring him here to live with us. She just went and got me. And, you know, I remember him looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and he says, yeah, you do, buddy. Come here. And he gave me a hug, and I fell asleep on that man's lap for probably the next 4 or 5 years every night, because he just made me feel safe, right? He was just always present, you know? And let me tell you, I wasn't an easy kid. I'm that kind of kid that probably should have been on something, right? You know what I mean? Before I got on something, I guess is how to say that. But I was one of those kids that just never thought anything out. I just did it, right? If I jumped off the roof and broke my arm, I'd jump off the other side of the roof, right? So my grandpa, he was an old railroader, and he really didn't know what to do with me, right? He was retired. He already raised 3 kids. And now he has this kid just staring at him all the time. And I remember almost every day was like a first date with him, right? He would stand in the kitchen, and he would look at me and rub his face like this. And I would rub my face like this, because he did. And he would just say, get in the truck. And then we go drive around all day, right? And that's what we did. And he was always there, right? I remember when he bought me my first bicycle. It was a BMX bike. I had been riding the Schwinn bike with these big handlebars and a banana seat for quite a while. And I was like, man, he bought me this BMX bike. And I thought, man, I have arrived, right? And I went on the back porch before I even rode the bike, right? And I had to modify it. So I was lowering the seat, and I was putting the handlebars forward. And then I had this number thing that was supposed to go on the front of the handlebars. So I started taking the brakes off, right, because they were in the way. And I remember my grandpa coming out, and he's like, hey, bud, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm modifying my bike. He's like, what exactly are you doing? I said, well, I lowered the seat, and I put the handlebars a little forward, and now I'm taking the brakes off so I could put this number on the front handlebars. And he's like, well, how are you going to stop? Well, I hadn't really thought about that. So I did what he taught me to do. I rubbed my face a little bit, and I walked around. I'm looking at that bike, and I said, well, here's what I'm going to do, Gramps. He goes, what's that? I said, I'm just going to rub my foot on the back tire till it slows down, and then I'll just jump off, right? And he just looked at me and said, well, when you crash, land on your head, because you have nothing up there to hurt. And he walked off and went back in the house. And I remember thinking to myself, that old man don't know nothing, right? Well, where I grew up, everybody parked in the street, and there was a strip of grass and then a concrete sidewalk and then about 25 concrete stairs with another sidewalk with a porch with about 5 to 6 stairs. And I'm bringing my bike down for the first time, and my buddy says, hey, I bet you can't ride your bike down the stairs. And without even thinking, I took my bike up on the porch. I said, yes, I can. And I made one of my first major mistakes. I pushed off when I started going to get more speed. And by the time I hit the concrete stairs, I couldn't get my – I was just holding on, really, to tell you the truth. The bike was bouncing and hopping, and I was just hoping to get to the bottom eventually. And sure enough, I got across, and I hit the freaking my grandma's car and split my head wide open. And I just do what everybody does at that point. I just started crying, right? And my grandma comes out and she's not happy. She's asking me questions like, what were you thinking? I'm trying to explain to her. I just didn't really think I was going to go that far. You know what I mean? It was completely unexpected. More importantly, I'm thinking to myself, I shouldn't have took my bike up on the porch. I should have did it from the concrete. So my thinking is not always right, right? And so we go into the kitchen to clean me up, and my grandpa hasn't even got out of his chair. He's still watching the news. It's like a typical Tuesday for him, I guess. So my grandma cleans me up, and she says, Gerald, you need to take him to the hospital. He needs to get some stitches. And I remember my grandpa getting out of his chair kind of disgusted, right? And he grabs his keys, and as we're walking out the door to go down the stairs, he's like, it's a good thing you took them brakes off, huh? And I was like, yeah, but I landed on my head, you know? And we just started laughing, right? And that's how our relationship was. I would go to jail. He would bail me out. If I got in trouble, he was always there, good or bad. When I did something really good, he was there, right? He's always consistent. He's the kind of guy that if you dropped a dime on the ground, he'd spend a dollar trying to get it back to you. He was just a good person. He just had this grandkid that he don't know how he got him, but he got him. And I was wild, right? You know, but we learned how to survive, him and I. But my grandma, on the other hand, my grandma's that lady that just loves you no matter what. You know, one of those ladies that just goes to church on Sundays and Wednesdays and Thursdays, and she's involved in everything, and she's making pies for everybody, and then she has this grandkid that she just has to love. And, you know, I wasn't an easy kid, right? I wasn't that one that got A's in school. I was the kind of kid that when I was going into the sixth grade, I remember the time that my relation changed with my grandma. I was going into the sixth grade, and I hadn't seen a recess in like 3 months, which was not that big of a deal to me, but it was to her. And so she came to the school, and I had just gotten kicked off the bus, so I thought my grandma was coming to pick me up, and she wasn't. She was coming to take me into this office to meet with all the teachers and the counselors. And I remember we went into this office, and there was a table, and there was like a principal, a couple counselors, a couple teachers, and a lady from another school for kids with special needs. And I remember sitting at this table, and I remember them saying everything that I had done. They had a list of stuff that I'd done, how I wasn't achieving in class and all sorts of things. And I remember looking at my grandma, and she wasn't saying anything. She was just listening. And she had that look of when she picked me up at the front door, right? And when they got done, she said, may I say something? And they said, yes. And she said, I'll tell you, I'm not going to deny Jason did any of those things. He lives at our house. We get it, right? But he's a good kid. There's a good person inside of there. The reason I know this is because every morning before he goes to school, he runs down to Mrs. Harrington's house and he throws her newspaper up on the front porch so she doesn't have to come down. And Shane, the young man, is simple-minded. Every time I see him at the store or at church, the first thing he asks is, where's Jason? Because Jason's his friend and nobody picks on him when Jason's around, and Jason always picks him first for sports. So I know Jason's got a good spot inside his heart. It's our responsibility as adults to get to know it, not him to find it. And I ended up not having to leave that school, and I ended up having my best year, right? But most importantly, when I left that office, I remember looking at my grandma on the way out thinking, my God, somebody loves me no matter what, right? That somebody has my back and somebody sees the best in me. And that lady, from that day on, I made that lady my best friend no matter what. You know what I mean? I tried to make her happy. I tried to do everything I possibly could to make her proud of me, right? And you know, I did really well until I got introduced to alcohol, you know, and I got introduced to alcohol in the sixth grade. I went to go stay at a buddy's house, sleep in the backyard. I don't know if you guys do that back there, but we do it like 3 times a year here if it's nice. We're in this backyard. We're getting our tent set up, and all of a sudden his mom comes out and says, hey, we're going bowling. I put some money on the table, and I ordered you guys a pizza. The pizza is coming. Make sure you guys pay the pizza man and stay in the house and don't cause no problems. And so they left to go bowling. His family did, and the pizza came, and my buddy Leif said, hey, pizza tastes better with beer. I said, yes. I had never drank beer, but I said, yes, it does. And he went downstairs and brought up a case of Lucky Lager beer. And let me tell you, it was nasty, right? I don't know what you guys, but it, you know, we had 3 or 4 beers. And the next thing I know, I got food poisoning. Something was wrong with the pizza, right? So I tell my buddies, hey, I got to go home. I don't feel good. I think I got food poisoning. That pizza sucks, right? And so I ride my bike home drunk with no brakes. And I get home and I go to my bedroom. And I'm sick all night, and there was no attention to me. Usually my grandma would put a pillow out and a bowl beside the bed, and she would pat me on the head and check on me. Nothing, crickets all night. And I finally get to sleep, and next thing I know, my grandpa's at the end of my bed screaming, get up, you're going to go to work. I'm trying to explain to him I don't feel good, really. I'm sick. And second, I don't have a job, right? Well, none of that was working for him. So he said, if you're going to drink like a big boy, you're going to work like a big boy. Now let's go. And so as we're heading out the door, my grandma hands me a warm egg salad sandwich and a big thermos of warm milk and tells me have a great day. and we go pick up Lathan and Sean, who are looking just as bad as I am, and we go pick strawberries. I don't know about you, but it's illegal in the state of Oregon to have a minor pick strawberries, and I think my story is a big part of that, right? It was the worst day of my life. I remember puking, picking strawberries, and looking at my grandpa sitting on his truck laughing and drinking his coffee and reading his paper. And I finally looked at my friends and said, man, I'm not drinking anymore. And they said, what do you mean? You didn't like the alcohol? I said, I love the alcohol. I just don't like the work, right? So I quit cold turkey. No AA, no 12 steps, no treatment, nothing. Just done, right? And I was pretty proud of myself. And I didn't really work another day for quite a while. But when I got to high school, something happened. What I found out is I was good at sports, and we'd play sports during the week, and then we'd drink on the week. ISR booze for the weekend. And that's how it was. Nobody was going to jail. Nobody was doing that. But my mind was always focused on, it wasn't my grades, it wasn't my sports. It's like, how much money are we going to have on Thursday so we have booze on Friday and Saturday? And that's how the cravings came in, you know. And like I said, nobody was going to jail. Nobody was getting in trouble. I mean, I got a minor in possession a couple, and I lost my driver's license until I was 21. But, you know, those are details, right? That's just part of being a young man getting grown up, I guess. But when alcohol really did something to me was on May 5th, 1989. The police report says that I stole a motorcycle, and I was eluding them, and I crashed, and I had a bunch of dope in my pocket. My version of the story is I borrowed them, what happened and stuff like that. She says, well, you're not going to die, but you're probably going to lose your left leg. And I remember asking her what exactly happened. She said, you were involved in a drunk driving accident. And I asked her, did anybody else get hurt? And she said, no. And I remember right then I had a little bit of relief. And I remember in that hospital telling myself, I'll never drink again. I'll never drink alcohol again. That is the problem. I can't believe I did this. And that was at the time when there was mad mothers against drunk drivers and there was all this stuff. So I would think I wouldn't drink. But, you know, 3 or 4 days out of that hospital, I was drinking because the obsession and the craving and the anxiety in my stomach was so hard and so scary that the only thing that would take it away was alcohol, right? And I would drink and I would drink and I would drink. And the thing was, is I had a good story going for me. I had a lot of people that felt sorry for me. A lot of people let me sleep on their couches. A lot of people bought me booze. And it just, I was going nowhere, right? But eventually my quality of life, I just kept lowering, and my standards just keep up with my quality of life. So eventually I was sleeping in a house where it was somebody's uncle's house until the police came, and then nobody knew whose house it was, right? And I was sleeping in a house like this, and eventually I got kicked out in the backyard, so I'm in a tent. And every couple months, one of my uncles would show up at my tent and tell me, hey, you need to go call your grandma. She's driving me crazy. She's calling every morning. She calls every hospital, every jail, all your friends, all of us, all of our relatives. Has anybody seen Jason? Does anybody know where Jason is? Is Jason alive? And please, somebody go find Jason. And so my uncles would come get me, just because they were getting tired of my grandma calling every morning, you know, and they would take me to a payphone, and I would call my grandma and tell her I love her, and I missed her, and that I had a job, and I was working out of town, and I would come see her as soon as I got back into town, you know. And what I thought then is, I thought, if she can't see me, I'm not hurting her, right? If she can't know, she doesn't know what I'm doing, I'm not hurting her. Today, being sober and sitting with other families, I realize today, man, when we're the alcoholic or the addict and we're running, we're the lucky one, right? So it's people that have nothing in their body, have no solution to that thing except a God that they believe in, and they're praying for you. And I realized that pain I was causing her, but alcohol made it so I didn't want to show up, right? My thinking was, I didn't want her to see me the way I was. I knew I was a piece of crap. I just didn't want her to believe that. You know, about on December 5th, 1997, my uncle Leroy showed up at my tent, and it was a nighttime, and he said, hey, your grandma's been in ICU for about a week and a half. They took her off of life support. You need to come say your goodbyes. And I told him, I don't want to go. He said, I'm not here to tell you, ask you to go. You're going. And my uncle Leroy can beat me up. So I got in his truck, right? And I remember when I got in his truck, he handed me a pint of vodka, and he said, drink this. It's going to be all right. And I remember chugging that down and getting to that hospital. And I don't know about you guys, but when somebody's in the ICU here in Portland at Adventist U, everybody waits out. I have a big family. They all wait out in this waiting room, and like two or three people can go in at a time. And I remember I got off that elevator, and I didn't look up, man. I knew I was a piece of crap, and I wasn't going to mount to anything, and I didn't need anybody else to tell that or to encourage that, right? And so I went and sat on the other side of the room all by myself, and nobody really came and talked to me, not even my mom. And then finally my one aunt comes up to me, and she says, Jason, you need to go in there and say goodbye and get out of here. And I said, all right. And so I went in there. My Uncle Gary and my Uncle John are in there, and I remember grabbing my grandma's hand, and she hadn't been up and talked in a couple of days. And I said, Grandma, it's me. And she opened up her eyes and started talking to me. And I panicked, right? I didn't know what to do. I just, I did what I knew how to do, right? I told her I loved her and that I missed her and that I was working out of town. And I'm doing really good in my life. And I got a car and a bunch of stuff. And I'll come see you tomorrow because there's a bunch of people that want to talk. Even they're not feeling like, I just felt so low. I didn't know how to take it, right? And I left and I just walked home, you know, and a couple of days later, my Uncle Dale showed up at my tent and explained to me that my grandma had passed the memorials the next day and that he would come pick me up to take me and maybe I could shower and clean up a little bit. And I said, okay. And then next day when he showed up, I hid in the I didn't know how to deal with life without her. All I knew is to drink, and I didn't go. You know, I know that this is going to be for the rest of life, and I would tell myself, drink so much, or they do so much, they wake up and they'd be pissed off as they woke up. Today, I remember waking up and just going, how am I still here, right? How is that possible? How can I do this? Just gone. And I didn't know my uncle from a payphone. My Uncle Gary, who was in there, and I asked him if he was going to church, and he said yes. And I figured, I asked him if I could meet him there because I knew he was going to beat me up, right? He's the closest to me. We're 7 years apart. He's got like 17 years of sobriety now, but this time I knew he would beat me up. I just was hoping it wouldn't be in front of a bunch of people, right? So the safest thing for us to do was go to church. And I remember we're sitting in church and they're singing How Great Thou Art. And then they sing Amazing Grace. And man, I just got caught up in the moment, right? And they're singing Amazing Grace. And I look at my uncle and I said, hey, I think I have a drinking problem. And he's like, you think? And the whole church is quiet, right? My aunt said the song was over. I thought everybody was quiet for me. And I said, maybe I might have a drug problem too if it makes you feel all right with yourself. What I heard him say, which I come to find out later, wasn't what he said. I heard him say, come over to my house. We'll feed you, give you a shower. I'll give you 20, 30 bucks, and we'll send you on your way, right? That's what I thought. I could have swore to this day on a Bible. That's what I thought he said. I get to his house. I shower, and when I come out of the shower, he has a phone book, which is, I don't know. You guys probably know what a phone book is. It seems like everybody's my age here, but there's a phone book on the counter, and he says, you're going to go to treatment. You need to call a treatment center. I said, I don't know what treatment is, and I don't even know anybody in treatment center. He said, call the hospitals, start now. And I thought, well, it's a Sunday afternoon. Really, there should be nobody working in treatment on Sundays. And the first place I called, Adventist, was open. And I explained to this lady that my uncle thinks I have a drinking problem and I need to go to treatment. She kind of giggled and laughed and patched me over to another person. And I made this appointment. They said, if you come here at 8 o'clock in the morning, we will do an intake and an assessment. If you fit in, we'll put you in treatment. So I said to my uncle, I said, hey, I got an appointment at 8 o'clock in the morning. How about you give me 20 bucks and I'll tell you how it goes. And he said, no, you're going to stay the night here. And that was a bad deal, right? Because he had a leather couch. He says it was leather. I'm going to tell you right now, because it's just us, it was plastic, right? And he has this dog, this little dog, like a French bulldog, that was licking me all night, right? So I'm on this plastic couch. I haven't eaten anything in my body for about 48 hours. It's just miserable. I'm sweating from the inside out. This little dog's licking my legs, licking my head, licking my back. It's just miserable, right? And so the next morning, he has the nerve to come down and say, man, you look like shit. You better take another shower. I wanted to tell him, yeah, because your couch is fake and your dog's been licking me. But I got in the shower. And when I got out of the shower, he got in the shower. And right then I knew, I just remembered. I don't know what happened all night, but I remember he had a liquor cabinet, right? And so I went to this liquor cabinet. There was some Bacardi 151. I took some of that and I poured it in a Coke can. I started drinking and I'm ready to go to treatment, right? I don't know what treatment is, but I'm all in. We get in his truck and I'm drinking my Bacardi, and he goes, hey, I smell alcohol. And so I chug it and tell him, it's not me, I'm going to treatment. And now I know that's just me, right? And I crushed that can up and put it by the door so he couldn't get it. And I made another huge mistake, like with that. I went to the bathroom to hide the Coke can from him, And he went in and told the counselors what was going on. And I thought, and so I go in there, and lo and behold, I answered yes to one question. I ended up in treatment, you know, and I made a very poor decision here too, because I went to an Adventist where they have no caffeine, no sugar, and no women, right? And at 27 years old, those are all pretty big deals in your life, right? And so I'm looking at these four other drunks, and I'm thinking to myself, could it get any worse? And it did, you know what I mean? They started sharing, and I'm thinking to myself, what the hell did I get into? But I remember they started talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. They started talking about this van coming to pick us up. I asked them, what do I got to do? They said, to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you got to go talk to this guy, Tim. And I went up to this Tim guy, and I gave him everything I had, right? I said, can I go? He said, yeah, all you have to do is sign your name on this paper. And I'm thinking, I overcommitted on a lot of stuff, really. But I got in the van, right? And I need to tell you, about 3 years before this was all going down, my dad called up my mom to pay back all the back child support he owed, right? And I went to this bank to get my half of the money, which I paid back because of strong sponsorship. But I went there to get my half of the money because I told my mom, you wouldn't be getting any of it. It wasn't for me, even though she made me. That was my rational thinking. So I go to this bank. I see this guy for like 2 minutes. I grab my half of the money and I take off and go use. So 3 years later, I'm in this van and I'm driving. And I remember, I treated God like I owed him money, right? I knew he was out there. I just didn't want to run into him, right? But I said a prayer to him. I said, God, please don't let me know anybody at this meeting. And if I do, please don't let me owe him money, right? So we go to this meeting, and sure enough, there's a bunch of ladies in there, and there's a bunch of candy, and there's a bunch of caffeine, and I have this blue wristband, and I'm trying to hide it, and I'm smiling at any woman that would look at me, and I turn around to look to see if there's any behind me, and I see this guy, and I tell these guys I'm with, I go, hey, that looks like my dad. They said, that's your dad? You don't even know who your dad is? I said, man, I've seen him one time in like 27 years. And so sure enough, they have a break at this meeting, and I walk up to this guy, and I said, hey, do you know who I am? He said, no. I said, I think you're my dad. And he said, Jason? And I said, yeah. And I met my dad at my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So that was kind of like a burning bush, right? That was kind of like, wow, you know what I mean? There might be something going on here, right? And so he asked me if he could come visit me at my treatment. I said, absolutely. My uncle's the only one coming, and my mom, both of them need treatment, but they're more enthused about mine, which happened to make family day go an extra week because I forgot to tell my mom that my dad was coming. And what I realized today is my dad was doing a ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad had 3.5 years at that time, and today I think he has about almost 26, 27 years. But you know what? He was an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what that did is he started dragging me along to see the people. And at 30 days, he took me to a meeting with a beautiful lady as a secretary. And lo and behold, I ended up going on a date with her, and about 3 months later, she's pregnant. So if you're new here, I did everything backwards. I got in a relationship in the first year. We got pregnant like in 3 months. We had a kid when I had about a year and a half. And I was just nuts, man. I was just nuts. I was going to one meeting a month. It was called SSAAL, Sit Down, Shut Up, and Listen. And it was a speaker meeting. And the only reason I was going is because I was the raffle chair and I stole half the money. But again, made me pay it back. A lot of money at the time, but when I had to pay it back, it added up. But I was going to this meeting once a month, but I didn't want to go this Saturday, and I was trying to get out of it. So I got in a fight with my wife, and I asked her for a divorce, and she said no, which threw me off. I didn't know you could just say no, right? I thought we had to negotiate to get an attorney. She said, no, I'm going to the meeting. Maybe you should go. You're the raffle chair. So she leaves in her car and leaves, and so I do what every good AA does. I go find the big book and a Bible, and I write a resignation letter to Alcoholics Anonymous, right, because I'm going to resign. And so I write this letter, and I date it, and I type it up, and I sign it, and I put it in this envelope, and I take it to this guy named John B. John B., I thought, was the president of AA, right? He had all these guys. So I call them Nottigans, right? Some people call them sponsees, pigeons, ducklings, whatever. I call them Nottigans, right? They're the kind that they're always greeting. So when you get there, you're like, good God, not again. Or when they get called on, they always talk about God, the steps, the allergy, the vibe, the session, the mind, the sponsor. I mean, it's just the same shit over and over. And you're just like, good God, not again. Why would? So I just named them all Nottigans, right? So I'm going up to give him my resignation letter. And I walk up to this guy, and this is like 600-700 people at the speaker meeting, right? And I hand him my letter, and he opens it up, and he starts laughing, like drawing attention laughing, right? So all these Nottigans are swarming over. I'm sweating and glistening. It's not going really well. And he's just laughing like Disneyland laughing, right? And he says, no. I was like, man, that's the second no I got today. I didn't know you could. I said, what do you mean no? He goes, I'm not going to allow you to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, Jason. And what accidentally came out of my mouth is, will you sponsor me, right? Not meaning to, but that's what came out of my mouth. And that guy quit laughing just like that, right? He's telling me, are you willing to go to any links for victory over alcohol? I was like, man, I was just wrote a letter to resign to AA, right? And now I ask you, the king of the not against, to be my sponsor. That's any links, baby. He said, well, this is what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to pray twice a day on your knees. You have to get on your knees every morning and you need to say, please help, thank you, amen. And get on your knees at night and say thanks. Nothing more, because you'll be trying to con God. You talk too much anyway, he told me. I said, fine. He says, you need to read 2 pages out of the big book after we go through the big book together for the rest of your life. I said, that's easy. He won't know if I'm doing that. Then he told me I had to call him every morning at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was like, might as well get a better job, right? You know? And then he says, I have to go to 5 meetings a week to where he's at. I'm like, 5 meetings in 1 week? That's like a 6 month coin at the rate I'm going. He said, I said, okay, right? And then he told me, try not to drink in those meetings. He said, if I do those 5 things, my life will get better in spite of myself, right? And I believed him. And what happened is he introduced me to that program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He made me feel part of. He put me in a greeting line. He made me hug people, and I hate hugging. And he made me do this, and he made me do that, but he made me part of. But when you don't do any of the steps, you just talk about the steps. And when you haven't admitted to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, man, you're just stealing a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous is what we say back here. Back there, I don't know what they say. They might say just watching, right? But I wasn't up front. I wasn't doing anything. And at 9 years of sobriety, I started taking some unprincipled actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started doing things at 9 years sober that I were on my fourth and fifth step. And I got pretty good at one of them. Well, I was selling drugs, right? And so I was doing pretty good at it. And I bought a car and I took it to this place called Les Schwab. They put some wheels and tires on this car. I pull out and the wheel falls off. And Les Schwab rented me this Chrysler 300. Never had a car like this. It looked like a Rolls Royce. I thought, man, I have arrived. So I went and picked up 157 grams of meth. At least that's what it weighed up to when the cops did it. But I bought this 157 grams of meth and I'm driving down the road sober, minding my own business. All of a sudden, these cops swarm my car, and I don't mean like one or two. I'm talking like, yeah, there was way too many, right? They were overreacting. So I pull over because there's nowhere to go because the whole street shut down, and I'm trying to act like I don't know what's going on. And so I'm thinking, shoot, man, I don't even know where a hiding spot is. So I just figured, I'll just put this dope underneath the front seat because it's a rental car. I've only had it for like 20 minutes, right? So I have proof of insurance, a valid driver's license. So it was the guy. They delivered it with the dope in it, right? That was my story, and that was my plan. But what happened is an officer came up and he knocked on the window and he said, Jason, can you shut the car off and step up on the curb? Which is another bad sign when they don't even ask you for ID. So I step up, I shut the car off and I open up the door to get out. And as I'm getting out, I hear this, and I look down and see him back all by itself. I never had a car that had a memory seat, right? I didn't even know cars did that. But the seat was like slow motion and it's going back and back and back. And I'm thinking, oh, shit, right? And you can't yell do-over or timeout, right? And you can't reach down and move it underneath the seat. So my best thinking was, well, maybe I'll just shut the door and hopefully they don't see it, right? So by the time I shut the door, the dope is in the middle. It's like a small basketball. It's in the middle of the floor like an idiot. My seat's way back here, and there's a group of people surrounding the car, right? So I go up on the curb, and they saw it, right? And I got charged with commercial delivery, commercial possession, racketeering, intimidation of a federal witness, and a gun charge with 9 years of sobriety, right? And my life changed, right? I just, God did for me. This is what, so my sponsor, John, made me write Chrysler a thank you card for helping me do for me what I couldn't do for myself, right? So God and them did that for me. I thought that was the worst freaking thing. But I got in a Chrysler like a couple months ago at an airport and the seat didn't move back. I told my wife they must have got my letter, but that's a whole nother story. That's just my ego in the way. But, you know, I ended up getting booked into this. Yeah, it got bad, right? I didn't think it'd get any worse. And I'm sitting in a booking cell with about 25 guys. And all of a sudden, Meth Watch 2007 comes on the news. And there's a picture of this dope. And they zoom in on it, right? So it makes it look like there's a whole lot. A bunch of money, a gun, and my driver's. I mean, they made me look guilty, right? And my attorney said, you are guilty. We're just trying to get you a reduced sentence, right? I was like, man. But what happened is everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. My family saw that. Everybody, all this lies, all in, right? The embarrassing shame. I had a daughter that was 7 years old. I had a wife that loved me. I had a house. I had a good job. And I threw all that away. And the only way I know how to do is run and drink, right? And so that's what I did for the next about 7 months. And I remember my lowest part, and it got bad, right? My wife divorced me, which was a great call on her behalf at that time. She has married me since then, which is her. You know, they used to say, at first they used to tell her, man, you're a saint for marrying Jason. Now they just look at her and say, what the hell are you thinking of marrying that guy twice? You got an out, right? And you went back. But we're married today, and we have a, you know, we have a great life. But then she divorced me. But I remember she let me come see my daughter every once in a while, shower at her house if it looked, because I was living in the bushes. And I remember one day, the lowest part for me, I was coming out of the shower, and she's coming down the hall. And we saved my daughter all these quarters with the states on the back, right? We started saving them when my daughter was born. We had three buckets of quarters. And my wife's coming down the hall going, you stole your daughter's money. How do you steal a six-year-old kid's money? How low can you get? And, in my head, I'm trying to justify what I did, right? Like, it was my money. I put the coins in there. She's too young to have it. But what killed me was my daughter's tugging on my wife's pants saying, please don't make my daddy leave. I let him borrow it. And when she said that, there's something inside me that hit me that hurt, right? And I ran. I put a needle in my arm, and I just didn't come back. I ended up getting sentenced to 48 months in prison because I just didn't show up, you know. And when I'm going to tell you, if you ever get arrested in the state of Oregon, the sheriff's office has been running the jail system since the 1800s. They don't need your opinion. Nobody told me that. I gave them my opinion. I ended up in the hole for 3 weeks. When I was in that hole, was the first time I hadn't had anything in my body in quite a while, right? And I remember sitting in this holding cell on this concrete bench, and nobody was going to come see me for another 23 hours. And I always had anxiety, and I had fear, and I was sweating, and I was scared, and I didn't know what to do. And I remember what John said, get on your knees and say, please help, thank you, amen. And I got on my knees, I said, please help, thank you, amen. And I got on that bunk, and if I got a little bit of serenity, I would get back on my knees, and I would say thanks. And then it was in there with no big book, no nothing, just me and God, that I admitted to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, that I'm an addict, and I am the problem, and I need help. And I made that relationship with God, and I started working on that. You know, and I got put into the population, and the very first meeting of AA that I got to go to, the man, Mike Scaife, who was standing next to my dad at my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember getting patted down to go, and I told him, God, please don't let me know anybody in this meeting, right? And we get there, and lo and behold, the guy who's bringing the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous into the jail cell doing H&I was Mike, right? He was at my very first meeting with my dad. He was at my very first meeting when I came back. And he gave me a hug and told me he loved me. And it changed my life, right? It gave me a little bit of hope. And I went back and I started doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started working with guys in the jail. And it came to a time for, you know, where I couldn't forgive myself. But I got this, man, there was this guy, Randy. He's a, I don't know, every group has a Randy, right? He's one of those guys that, I ripped him off for $3,000, and he had a daughter in college, two daughters in high school, and a boy with special needs, and I ripped him off. I said I borrowed it, but I ripped him off, right? And he's that kind of guy that would always call you and say, I'm loving you, I think about you, kind of ruin your day, right? And I get called down to visitation, and I go into this room, and it's just a plexiglass with two phones, and you're going to be there for 45 minutes, and the guy walks in, and it's Randy. I'm like, good God, could it get any worse, right? You know, when you owe somebody money and you get stuck in a closet with them, right? It sucks, right? But I did what you guys told me to do. I invited God to go with me. And when I sat down, I told Randy, man, I'm sorry for stealing that money from you. Whatever I got to do, I'll make that right. And he said, Jason, I'm not here for the money. He said, I'm here to tell you I love you and I'm glad you're doing all right. Most importantly, my kids and my wife have come to me and they gave me their Christmas money and they want to buy your daughter and your wife something from you from Christmas. What do you think they would want? And I just started crying, right? I didn't, that's the only things I've heard of. I didn't realize that people did those things, right? I didn't believe, look, I've tried to pay Randy back. He won't take my money. I've helped landscape both his daughter's houses. I built his fence in the backyard. I helped him paint his house. He's abusing our relationship now, really, if I start doing an inventory on this, but it's just not right, right? I give him $3,000 all day long, but he won't take the damn money, right? He just likes the relationship. But what that did is it gave me hope. If that man could do that and he can give somebody else something, you know, an old timer in our area said, Jason, if you show up to Alcoholics Anonymous when it's not convenient or necessary and you give when you can't afford it, your life's going to get better. And that's what Randy did. He gave to me and he didn't care about the thing. And what happened was I just started building relationships. I started getting back out. I got released after 3 months and 27 days on a 4-year sentence. I got released because some judges in our area signed a piece of letter. It got me released to suspend my sentence and released to serve my time in the community. And all I had to do was get sober and get a job. And I haven't looked back, right? My sobriety date's 11/30/07, and I haven't looked back. And, you know, I want to share with you how I got that amends with my grandma, right? I don't know, man. I would drive by that cemetery and I would just get this ache inside my stomach, right? How do you do that to somebody you love? Howard Poland sat with me a long time and we wrote letters and put it in a mailbox and mailed it to Santa Claus or whoever it went to. And I went to the gravesite and I looked for butterflies, bluebirds, ants, whatever crawling on the ground. I did everything you guys suggest. I had flowers delivered to her cemetery every Friday for a year, right? I did everything I possibly could, and each one of those things helped me, right? It gave me some relief. But sometimes I would just get sick to my stomach thinking, how do you treat somebody like that, right? How did I do that? What, I didn't think of the alcoholism. I just thought, how do I do that? And then one day a guy named Jimmy Jack from your guys' area, he sent me this letter, and it was about this little boy who, he was the firstborn in his family, and he was his dad's favorite because he was the only one, but then he got two sisters and his dad started paying attention to his sisters, but he knew his dad loved football. So he went and asked his parents, hey, can I play football? And this young man, he don't like sports, right? He don't like being hit. He don't like to run. He's a little chubby. He's just not a football player. But he joined the football team because after every single practice and every single game, his dad would come up and give him a hug and tell him he loved him and how proud he was of him. And this little boy just bought into that. And as they got older and older and older through the years, that happened after every game, every practice, his dad came. And the kid kept playing because he just wanted that attention. You know, and it was his senior year, and his team was going to the state championship, and couple weeks before the big game at practice, and the coach called him over and goes, son, I need a tea. He goes, what's up, coach? He said, I don't know how to say this to you, but your dad had a heart attack today and he didn't make it. And the young man, he got up and he asked the coach if it was okay if he goes home a little bit early. And the coach said, you just go home and take care of your family. This is just a game. Don't worry about this. Go home and take care of your family. And don't worry about football. And so the next couple weeks, there are some articles in the school paper, and the big game came and the kid didn't show up until the fourth quarter. And when he showed up, his team was losing, but it kind of gave everybody a boost when he ran out on the field. And he asked the coach if he could play, and the coach just told him no because he's the worst player on the team. But eventually he let the kid in, and the kid intercepts the first ball and runs it back for a touchdown. And he's just making all these tackles. He's just playing out there phenomenal, right? And it gets down to the last play, and his team's losing by four, but the other team's punting the ball. So somebody's going to have to run it back in or the game's going to be over. But lo and behold, this young man runs in, blocks the punt, runs it in for a touchdown, and wins the game. It's like a Rudy moment, right? And he gets carried off and everybody's cheering. It's just like a movie. And that night, as the coach is leaving the locker room, he sees a young man sitting in the corner, and he walks up to him. He says, man, take as long, much time as you want. And the kid says, thank you. And the coach turns around and says, hey, I need to ask you a question. He said, don't take this the wrong way. You're the worst athlete I've ever coached. You don't run. You can't hit. You just don't like football. We still don't know why you're here, but you're just a good kid. We kept you on the team. What happened out there tonight? And the young man said, coach, I don't know if you know this, but my dad, after every single practice or every single game, even the games that I lost, the team game for us, or you didn't play me a bunch of games in a row, every single game, my dad would come find me and give me a hug and tell me how proud he was and that he loved me. And the coach is kind of standing there at the tearing eye. He goes, that's a good dad you had. And the young man says, coach, I don't know if you know this, but my dad was blind. And today's the first time he ever got to see me play. And just like that, I got relief. Right? Because I realized my grandma never got to see me get sober when she was on this planet. But every time I stand at a podium or I go into a meeting and say, my name is Jason Johnson, I'm an alcoholic. Or every time I walk into a meeting, I see somebody I don't know, maybe they're new, maybe they're a visitor, and I walk up and I shake their hand and say, I haven't seen you here before, my name is Jason, is it okay if I sit beside you? Every time I do those things, my grandma gets to see me play. And it just gave me relief, right? It's that it was just like alcohol that just took that away. And, you know, I know that when I go to that big meeting in the sky, because of the relationship you've given me with God, I know that when I go to the big meeting in the sky, my grandparents are going to be in the parking lot waiting for me to get there, because that's where I'm going to go first. And my grandpa will probably be leaning against his car, and he'll wave at me because he thinks you have to be a half hour early. You can't be a minute late. You have to be a half hour early to anything, or you're late, right? He'll wave at me like this because he doesn't think I know where I'm going. And I'll walk up to that man for the first time, and I'm going to be able to look him in the eye and tell him, thank you for giving me a safe place to live. And I'm going to be able to hug them because the men in Alcoholics Anonymous hugged me when it wasn't convenient and wasn't necessary. They made it all right for me to hug another man. I'm going to be able to hug them and tell them thank you and that I love them. But most importantly, my grandma, man, I talk to her every day, but she's going to be dancing, probably dancing around the parking lot. She's going to be praising Jesus and thanking God and probably telling my grandpa, I told you so. You know what? But I know exactly what she's going to do. She's going to hug me. She's going to tell me she loves me and how proud she is of me. For the first time in my life, I'm going to be able to look her in the eyes for the first time and say, Grandma, it's the damnedest thing. These folks in this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, they found a solution to their problem and they introduced it to me. But most importantly, Grandma, some of those folks showed me some grace. And in doing that, man, you guys introduced me to that guy inside of here that only my grandma knew existed. I hope I can never pay that debt back. That's why I do what I have to do, right? That's why I go when it's not convenient or necessary. You folks have given me that. You know, I used to end with that, but I'll end with this last story about last year when school was ending, I kept getting this phone call on my phone, and there was this kid, and he wouldn't leave his phone number. He'd just say, "Hey, I'm trying to get a hold of you, answer your phone." And it was like every hour, right? So finally we connected, and there's this young man, he's in the sixth grade, and his teacher in his class selected him to do an article in their class on the opiate addiction and alcohol addiction in the state of Oregon and in his city. And he had to interview a pastor, a police officer, a doctor, and a convicted felon, right? Well, I'm not the doctor, right? So we already got that out of the way, right? I'm not that guy, right? So I'm the convicted felon, I know, right? And he comes into my office and he's sharing with me and he's asking all these questions, and he was like looking at my stuff, but he said something to me that changed my life. He looked at me and he said to me, he said, "What's the coolest thing about being in recovery?" And I gave him a gratitude list that we have. You know, I did all this, I got all this, blah, blah, blah. I think he was looking for me to be friends with Tupac or Al Capone or something, right? That I knew somebody famous, but I said, "What's the coolest thing about being able to do this?" And the young man looked at me and he said, "The coolest thing about doing this is my teacher believed in me." And right when he said that, man, I just started crying. I'm the hand that said, "God bless me." But you know what I mean? How many times that we can change somebody's life by just believing in them? You know, I have one more story I need to share. My daughter grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife married me, right? And we got back together. We have a family, and my daughter was 17 years old, and I'll end with this, and my daughter's 17 years old. So my wife and my daughter come to me one day, and they said, "Hey, we're going to go on vacation." "Great, where are we going?" They said, "Well, we're going to Canada." I was like, "I can't go to Canada." They said, "We know," right? I was like, "Oh, all right." So they got in their car, and they drive to Canada, and all the way up there, they're taking pictures of all the signs, the police, and then they get to the border, pictures with the cops on this side, pictures with the whatever they are on the other side, pictures of Canada all the way, right? That's all I see is Canada, Canada, Canada. There's enough to annoy me, but me and my dog, we're hanging out, right? And it's not all that bad when you're by yourself. But all of a sudden, all the pictures stopped, right? And there was no communication. There was nobody calling me. And a couple of days went by, nothing, right? I'm thinking, well, either my wife left me for some Canadian guy, or they're arrested, or they crashed the car, right? So I start playing Perry Mason. I can't figure nothing out. But what happens is, lo and behold, they show up at the house, and you know, I go straight to the garage to look for dents in the car because that's what you do as a husband. And there's nothing. And as they walk in, my daughter runs straight to her room. And my wife comes in and she's talking to me. She said, "Hey, I need to share something with you. I need to talk to you about something." But you can't overreact or get mad. I said, "You know, I'm good. I knew something was coming." I said, I'll be all right. I won't overreact. What'd you do?" And she said, "Well, while we were in Canada, Bailey got a tattoo," right? I don't know. I have a sleeve, right? I've been to prison, right? But when your 17-year-old daughter gets a tattoo, man, I saw a tramp stamp. I saw stripper poles. I saw Aerosmith videos. And look, one of my best crime partners was a stripper. I have nothing against strippers. But when it's your 17-year-old kid, oh, man, somebody's going to jail and we're getting a divorce, right? So I told my wife, "You just wait right here. We're getting a divorce and you're going to jail because it's against the law to get somebody 17. So I go upstairs and I yell at my daughter, ask, "What the hell are you thinking? Getting a tattoo? You're going to be a stripper for the rest of your life?" And I'm just going on, and she's crying and my wife's crying. And this is where the story's different. I told her I was going for a ride. She told me to leave. So I'm in my car driving. I have one of the speaker phones and I do what every good alcoholic does at a time like this. You call an Al-Anon, right? Because Al-Anon is the right divorce attorney and how to get somebody put in jail. So I call this Al-Anon who I love and adore, and she answers the phone, and I explain to her without even saying anything, "Hey, Julie took Bailey to Canada. She's 17 years old. She got her a tattoo. It's against the law. I need a divorce attorney, and my wife needs to go to jail, and how do I get that tattoo off my daughter?" Nothing. Crickets, right? So I say the story again. Still nothing, right? And this is where I used to say that. I used to say, "Man, Al-Anon, this is why your group's so small, because you don't respond very fast." But that was me being stupid. What it is they listen to what you're saying, right? Right? They listen to, like, if you ask an alcoholic, "Hey, I have a problem," they give you the answer before, you know, "Hey, did you read about it, pray about it? Did you do an inventory on it?" We have answers to fit everything, right? We don't listen to the whole damn problem, right? There's plenty of stuff to do. Al-Anons listen to everything, right? So finally she says to me, she says, "Jason, you want to know what I heard?" I was like, "Yeah, absolutely. I've told you the story 3 times. What's your version, right?" She said, this is what I just heard. I heard you tell your daughter that she is not beautiful, that any decision she makes is not going to be up to your standards, and that her body is not your body, and you just don't respect her, right? And so I said, that's not what I meant. I mean, my wife got her text. You know, I'm trying to explain it driving down the road, and she says, that was not what we heard. This is what she heard as a kid. And I said, well, I didn't mean that. What do I do? She goes, you need to go back and make it right. And I could hear her husband in the phone going, you better invite God to go with you. So I'm doing this in the thing as I'm driving down the road, right? And I get to my house, and I'm in the driveway, and I invited God to go with me. And I go in, and I ask, I tell my wife, I said, man, I think I overreacted. She said, you did, right? And, the dog and me are pals, but he's on the other side of the room. She's like, I don't want nothing to do with this guy. He's an idiot. So I go upstairs and my daughter's on the bed crying, and I got to sit down beside her and tell her that I love her and that she's the most beautiful person I've ever met and that I don't know how lucky I am. And I don't care if she has 20 tattoos. I don't care if she's gay, straight, but whatever she does, I don't care. Right. I love you no matter what. And I overreacted and I'm an idiot. And she said, Dad, we knew you were going to overreact. I said, well, why didn't you give me a little bit more warning? You know what I mean? It went back to me again. And she said, well, you want to see the tattoo? I was like, oh, I said, yeah, I guess, you know, it's this, I'm this far into it. Let's go for it. And she lifts up her shirt, and on the side of her side, she has an AA symbol, and it says one day at a time. And it has two hands, one going like this down and another hand going like this up. So my first thought is, hey, you're not an alcoholic. Why do you have an AA symbol? The second thought I thought was, we're not Catholic. What's with the praying hands? But I didn't say anything. I've learned a little bit in the last 10 minutes, right? So I asked her, she goes, you want to know what it means? I said, well, sure. She goes, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, you and Mom would have never met and I wouldn't be here. And she said, the hand going like this is Mom's hands because she's always serving the coffee and making the cookies for the meeting. And she said, the hand going like this, hand up, that's your dad, your hand, Dad, because you're always welcoming people to Alcoholics Anonymous and giving them a hand up. So now I'm crying, right? And it's just not right, right? And I didn't think it could get any worse, and it did. I was at a conference. I had to speak at this conference called Rule 62 in North Dakota in the middle of January, right? Very bad idea, but I was there. And I'm with Polly Pistol, this lady, Carla Rao, and my wife. So it's a table full of all women. I should have never sat at it, right? But I sat at it just to be arrogant. Well, when my wife tells this story, it isn't as funny, right? And so my wife is telling the story, and I'm trying to look straight ahead. There's nothing going on, but I don't want to be part of the conversation because I could just feel the vibe going sideways. And this lady, Polly Pistol, goes, sweetie, sweetie. And I'm trying to ignore it. She goes, Jason. I go, yes, Polly. She goes, what's it feel like when God kicks you right in the nuts? And I was like, man, that lady scares the hell out of me, right? I avoid her like the plague now. But what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous is a gift. I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that my responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous is to allow somebody else to know that I believe in them. It's allowed to be able to make mistakes and go make those rights. I've been able to put relationships back together that I thought would never be related, put back together. You know, I want to thank you for my time. I think I went a little long. Bill, thank you for having me. Thanks.